So the final session of the conference is on not relations between our two national governments, but between and among our 10 provinces and 3 territories and the 50 American states. And our guests, who I think are waiting outside, are pretty well placed to talk about that. So please welcome Premier Jean Charest of Quebec and Governor Peter Shumlin of Vermont. Premier, Governor, thank you for being with us this afternoon. Governor, I have to tell you that Premier Charest skis at Mount Orford, but he only lives 20 minutes away from Jay, so once in a while I can sneak him across the border.
That's great. We'll take him any time. And all the rest of you, too.
This session is being moderated by my friend David Biette, who is the director of the Canada Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington. That's a If you know the Reagan Building in Washington, they've got 7 floors in there. It's a real think tank. And David, I think you're going to introduce briefly our distinguished guests and then get right into the conversation.
Je suis content d'être ici cet après-midi. Bienvenue tout le monde. Je suis content d'introduire nos deux invités. On my left, someone who in Montreal and Quebec really needs no introduction. I can't add anything to what you already know, except that I've known Monsieur Charest for about 20 years when he was Minister of Environment in the federal cabinet. We worked with him on a lot of issues, and I met him in New York. And about 6 years ago, I think, he came to the American Assembly in Harriman, New York, and gave a brilliant speech, which we're still just talking about. And then he's also spoken at the Woodrow Wilson Center about Quebec-U.S. relations. And it's been great to work with Quebec through the years. Governor Shumlin has extensive experience in the municipal level, which is also important, and the state level. He was a senator for, I think, 13 years in Vermont. He was elected the 81st governor of Vermont last fall and one of the very few Democrats elected in Vermont. Good to know. He was inaugurated on January 6th of this year and made his first official out-of-state trip to Quebec. So with that, let me ask you about your trip to Quebec and why Quebec, and tell me about your meeting with Mr. Charest.
Well, first of all, I'm delighted to be here, and thanks so much for inviting me. The first trip I made out of Vermont was to come to Quebec, meet with the premier, who I immediately bonded with, frankly, found a connection here. I just hope you keep reelecting him. And
Speak slowly.
That was unpaid. But, you know, it's funny. As you probably know, Quebec is Vermont's biggest trading partner. We are intertwined on so many issues, obviously energy, commerce, transportation, as well as family. You know, many of the people that elected me are originally from Quebec. They still speak French beautifully and better than I do. And the relationship with us in terms of our culture is really important. So I felt like it was important as my first mission to come up and get to know not only from here but many of you, and hope that we can just continue to build that relationship. Now, only in Vermont would this happen, but the former governor, who was a Republican, Governor Jim Douglas, and the former Lieutenant Governor Brian Duby, also from the opposite party, had a great relationship with Quebec. And so I turned to the Lieutenant Governor Brian Duby, who wanted the same job I wanted, and frankly, he got pretty close to getting it. It was a tight election. But anyway, I reached out to Brian, and I said, would you be willing to go up and introduce us to your friends in Quebec? And he did, and we had a marvelous time together. So that's how we do it in Vermont. We're not quite as partisan as some of the other states. We don't just drink tea. We drink coffee, too. And I'm delighted to be here.
Bravo. Well, that speaks volumes about the new governor of the state of Vermont. We had established an exceptional relationship with Jim Douglas, and I will speak maybe of that later. Jim Douglas and I initiated the idea of the premiers and the governors meeting at the National Governors Association meeting in February of 2010, which had never been done before, and that would have never happened without the friendship and the help of Governor Douglas. After the election campaign, Governor Shumlin defeated Brian Duby, who was his Republican adversary, and who we knew very well, also a friend of Quebec. But I want to tell you how impressed we were by how noble a gesture it was for Governor Shumlin to bring his adversary up with him to say, well, you know, we're all part of the same group and same team. So it speaks volumes of the relationship we have with Vermont. And there's a very real kinship between the people of Vermont and Quebec. So, and it speaks a great deal to where these relationships are and where they're going and what significance they have. So, and with Vermont, on energy, on the environment, on trade, because I'll give you one example. There's this extraordinary campus of IBM in the state of Vermont that has a very real relationship with the IBM plant in the Eastern Townships. And so there's a direct relationship at all levels between the people of Vermont and Quebec. And I think it's an example and probably a good laboratory of things to come in the relationship between states and provinces.
Well, we were putting this conference together. I knew we were going to aim for presidents and prime ministers and sort of the big diplomat stuff. But I also wanted to make the point that state-to-province issues are really, really important. We tend to ignore it. Academics don't pay too much attention to it. But I'm glad we got this panel together. And I want to ask you, what can you two do at your level of government, state-to-province, that can't be done at the federal level?
Well, do you want to go first? I'll take a shot at it. You know, we're at an interesting crossroads in our federal government in America. We really are at a point where, because of the division and the extremes of both parties, frankly, we don't expect a lot to come out of Washington. Certainly President Obama and the Democratic Senate is going to be playing defense against the Republican House. So our hope for change and for real progress is going to come from states. And then the question is, well, which states? Now, I can tell you, probably because of our proximity to Quebec, I would suspect that I'm the only politician in America that ran a campaign with ads promoting a single-payer health care system, where health care is a right and not a privilege, something you figured out some time ago, that ran on the issue of job creation as a result of the necessity for us to get off of our addiction to oil, to deal with the climate change issue head-on. That's something that the premier agrees with me on 100%, and other issues that create jobs. So my feeling is, frankly, that as a result of the elections in America, the power has shifted to governors in legislatures in states that are willing to make real change, and that Quebec and Vermont have more in common, frankly, than some of my Tea Party governors who are not promoting an agenda anything like mine. So this partnership must be built upon, and frankly, I think that we have a lot more in common that unites us than obviously that divides us, and we have a lot of potential to grow this relationship.
Well, let me put the relationship in the context. I know you heard yesterday from Prime Minister Mulroney and James Baker, and I'm sorry I missed it because I heard it was Mulroney in fine form. So we're going to miss him during this election campaign, I know. But I had the privilege of serving in his government, and I think there is a real story to tell in how the relationship between the states and the provinces is affecting the relationship between Canada and the United States. And let us start with the trade agreement itself in 1988, signed in 89, went on to become NAFTA. And the relationship at that level was very much between both countries. What I think we are witnessing in the world as integration proceeds in our economies, whether it's in Europe or in North America through NAFTA, and now we're negotiating a partnership Canada with Europe. As we integrate more and more, I think you will find that the jurisdictions and responsibilities of states and governments will interact more and more. And you will see that happen in a way where we are called upon to play a more active role. Now, I'll give you a few examples. Very recently, there was a trade dispute between Canada and the United States on the issue of government procurement after the legislation brought in on the Buy America Act. When the trade deal was signed in 1980s, there was no provincial government involvement on the issue of procurement, no responsibility. any agreement was signed between the national government of Canada and the national government of the United States. Well, at that time, Prime Minister Harper asked us, and I was the chair of the Council of Federation, whether the Canadian provinces would agree that in our areas of jurisdiction, we're a federal government, a federal country, we would agree to put our jurisdictions on the table to negotiate an agreement with Congress on the issue of Buy America, a compromise. Well, we actually did that, got that done within 3 days. 3 days. And there is a very real concrete example of how the responsibility of the provinces and the states will come into play more and more. So as I look ahead on a number of issues, you will see, I think, that relationship grow in importance. To speak to our broader relationship, though, it's interesting to note that there's both the bilateral between Quebec and Vermont, but there's also the more formal groups. There has been, for over 30 years now, a grouping of Canadian provinces and northeastern England states. And this council has met for every year for the last, 34 years, I think. There's a Western group also. And if you were to examine the issues that we have dealt and discussed over that 35-year period, plus, you'll find the environment and energy as being the core issues that we have discussed and debated. And things like acid rain. I see Robert Slater with us today, who used to be a deputy minister in the Department of Environment and one of the key players in the implementation of the acid rain agreement of 1990, the Clean Air Act. And so in that grouping. Now, on the bilateral level, the relationship has also grown in energy. But then a more recent example of how the relationship has changed is climate change. Who in North America has been leading the battle on the issue of climate change? Where has the initiative come from, if not the states and the provinces? The Western Climate Initiative, the California tailpipe emission standards that your province, that your state, Peter, adopted, that Quebec was the first to adopt. The leadership on climate change, on energy issues, and climate, certainly climate change and environment issues, has come from the provinces and states, not from the national governments. So that's part of the change I've seen in the last 20 years.
Taking that into mind, the extent of the work that you've done, where do we sort of run into limits at the top? Where does the federal government, where do Ottawa and Washington kind of say, oops, going too far? Or what are the challenges of working at the federal? I mean, you could almost do what you continue going, but we do have federal governments here. What are your challenges with them?
Well, you know, I think in terms of the U.S., at least Vermont's relationship with trading partner, it's how can we use, at least from my perspective as a governor, the resources of the federal government to help us build that relationship. Now, here's an example. The premier and I are working together with the New England governors to develop the first high-speed rail network from New York to Montreal with a spur to Boston. That's got to happen. We are not going to compete, and we're not going to conquer climate change-related issues if you can't get on a high-speed rail. Now, listen, if they can figure this out in Shanghai, and they can figure this out in Europe, and they can figure this out in Japan, we can figure this out in North America. So we have been meeting with the Secretary of Transportation, with President Obama and others. They're excited about it. They actually believe that we can get this done first in New England. Now, why is that? Right now, the President of the United States, and Premier Charest is committed to this at his end, has committed to spending billions of dollars on high-speed rail to get this done. Now, as a result of the election, I just got elected by the biggest class of new governors in the history of America. But I got to tell you, they drink more tea than they do coffee, let's put it that way. And so we have a bunch of governors, Governor of Florida just rejected billions of dollars worth of high-speed rail money. Well, what do we see? We're North Americans, we're smart, we see opportunity. So we have met with the Transportation Secretary, they've asked us to file an application by April 7th. New England governors have come together. We'll be working together with the premier, and we're going to try to gobble up some of that money. Now, there's a Tea Party governor in Ohio who's apparently about to do the same thing. I think New Jersey's about to fall. Wisconsin apparently thinks that high-speed rail is, I don't know, they think it's communism or whatever it is. We'll take it. You know, we'll take it. We're open for business. So, I do think what we have to ask as as state and provincial leaders is, how do we get our federal governments to work best for us to create jobs, economic opportunities, and make do that as a team? And I think we're well on our way to doing that.
I would say the federal government of Canada has been supportive, and over the last 15 years have recognized that there is an opportunity for provinces to play a larger role and that it serves the national purpose. For example, the national government, for the first time to my knowledge, it was a Colin Robertson that was introduced in the Canadian Embassy as someone to coordinate the actions of the provinces. Now, they have, you know, shared feelings about that because sometimes we'll go out there and say things they don't want to hear. And it never happens to me. Some other people say things they may not want to hear. But the federal government of Canada has been generally, I would say, very supportive. Where do we run into the limits of, a lot of times because we're more focused, that we're ahead of the federal government or national governments on some issues. Fast Train is a very good example. I think there's a lot of reticence in Canada about the idea of doing a fast train between Quebec City and Windsor. We've just ordered a study, and that study isn't yet made public. But there, put yourself in my shoes. I turn around, and I have a national government in the United States who are interested in this. I went to the NGA meeting. I asked for a meeting with Ray LaHood, who's the Secretary of Transport. They immediately say yes. I had a meeting faster than I could have with, you know, other circumstances and people in other governments in Canada. When I sat down with him, I said to him, we're very interested in this project. He said, yes, I know. He said to me very clearly, President Obama and Vice President Biden have decided this will be their legacy in the United States in the area of transport. It's that simple. And our response is, well, you know what? We want to make that happen. And so, but here we are, keep in mind, an area that's mostly in the area of federal jurisdiction. And then we turn around. Now things have turned around. There's a momentum is picking up for a fast train between New York City and Montreal, Boston and Montreal. This is a game changer for Montreal, to use an expression that's used too often. If there's a fast train between Montreal and New York, or Montreal and Boston, it's going through Vermont, Montreal is not the same city anymore. If it's plugged into a fast train system that's going to Quebec City and Windsor, we are not living in the same place. I have a federal partner here who is enthusiastically embracing the idea we do this together, but I have a federal partner in Canada that seems to be more indifferent to the project. Will it go ahead or not? So that's the limits that we run into. We'll run into a very clear, I'll give you a very practical example. We need to do a pre-clearing initiative at the in Montreal for the fast train to go to the United States if it's going to be effective. We shave off an hour and a half or 2 hours of travel time. Now, for that to happen, both the federal governments have to talk together. I can't make it. Peter can't make it happen alone. Neither can I. But both of us can certainly show the way.
One of the last big programs we did at the center was on pre-clearance, looking at the potential for Montreal, New York, what happens there, and using the example of the Olympics and how Seattle, Vancouver, the corridor, they've managed to work it out, and what's been done in San Diego as well, where you can park in San Diego and take a footbridge over to the airport in Tijuana. If we can figure that out, certainly we can figure this out.
And we must. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I consider myself partly Canadian because I own a house in Nova Scotia, Quebec, in Cape Breton. And, you know, it's not Quebec, but the Magdalen Islands aren't far away. I just want to remind you of that. And I can go down to Halifax Airport, get pre-cleared to fly into Boston or anywhere else. Well, if we can figure that one out, we can certainly get thousands and thousands of people pre-cleared out of the train station in Montreal. We just got to commit to getting it done.
Which brings me to my next issue, border security. What role do states and provinces have in border security? Is it all a top-down, or what can we do on the state-provincial level?
Well, I think, you know, we're facing a different challenge than we were pre-9/11, and I have always said, as a Vermonter who grew up next to Canada, you know, it isn't those uppity Canadians that we got to worry about. I mean, it isn't. You know, we tend to be friends. We're family. We like each other. We're good friends. We don't need borders dividing us. And I think one of the voices that I certainly carry to Washington as a governor is we understand that we need to be very careful about border issues. But we've got to make sure that it doesn't stand in the way of our friendships, our families, and our commerce with Canada. And it was interesting. I was at a fundraiser the other night in Burlington that Senator Leahy had invited Al Franken up. And the first thing that Al Franken said, Governor of Minnesota, I mean, U.S. Senator from Minnesota, won by a similar landslide as me, and and he said, you know, we share northern borders with Canada. And one of the challenges I found in Washington is, again, you know, we seem to build borders as if Canada is not our friend. So I think we can be a rational voice to remind federal government that we understand Al-Qaeda, but that we have family, friends, and commerce, and we've got to make sure that that border doesn't act as a barrier to what has been an extraordinarily important partnership.
One of the most important changes in the relationship between Canada and the United States has been the events of 9/11. And our relationship changed forever after that. And the ambassador of the United States in Canada at the time said it very well, Paul Cellucci, who was a past governor of the state of Massachusetts. He gave a speech in which he said, from now on, security trumps trade. And that's still true to this day. We are very cognizant of that. And I think any informed government in Canada, whether it's the national government or provinces, need to proceed from that premise. Security trumps trade. And we need to address and be seen as addressing security issues for American counterparts. Otherwise, we'll be in some difficulty. And our American counterparts need to address this matter. Even if time has gone by, this issue remains the number one issue. And so we are conscious of that. And what role do we play? Well, Quebec participates with Vermont in a common security group within the northeastern states that deals with issues in shared security. We, on a very practical level, there's the border, but there's every road that leads up to the border, on which we are investing now. We're investing on Highway 35 in the Derby-Vermont border, also a Stanstead border, which is in my part of the country. So that's where we play a role. There is a very important initiative that has been launched about a common security perimeter. And from my understanding, it's going to be work in progress. It's the kind of initiative that creates a great deal of nervousness within Canada about sovereignty, security, and what will happen. Canadians are going to be, I think, very watchful of that, and they're going to be concerned about that. But I also think that if we're going to get it right, that we need to address the border issues. Otherwise, the borders will become obstacles to trade, and we will face what some have described as the thickening of the border. And it's going to become an obstacle to trade. We've had initiatives like the WHTI, which now makes it obligatory to have a passport to travel before. And that has very practical effects for us. When we organize a convention in Montreal, a national or international convention, we invite American counterparts. Well, it means that all of them have to buy passports to come here. In a very practical term, if an American family from Vermont wants to come up to ski at Mont-Saint-Anne, their three kids and two parents, before they leave, they'll all have to buy a passport at $100 a piece before they leave home to be able to travel and back and forth, unless they have the special driver's license, which Vermont and Quebec did first, right, which is a good example. We were both the first to do it because of the relationship we had. And Jim Douglas was the first to have one driver's license in mine, and I'm not sure it's been that big a success. The take-up hasn't been as important as we thought. But there are real examples of what the border means to us. In our case, it's hockey teams and parents and people who, right, go back and forth every day. I got checked by a border guard in the United States who lives in Canada. In Quebec, the lady, I was traveling by plane to Vermont, get off the plane. She speaks French. Monsieur Charest, comment ça va? I voted for you in the last campaign.
I'm gonna hunt her down. She should have voted for me.
I know. She lives and works in the border. So that's how close we are and integrated we are.
And I think to be specific, to add to the Premier's comments, what can we do to be smarter about borders and still maintain security? I think the first is, in some of the smaller border crossings that the U.S. is proposing at least close down, which makes no sense at all, let's share facilities. I mean, we can do that together. There is no reason why we need to build two buildings, invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in building two separate units. You know, I think we can trust each other to work out of the same building. We tend to be able to do that. I think, you know, when we talk about very specific issues and taking those to Washington and talking sense into some of the bureaucrats there, that's how we can really get this done, maintain the smaller crossings, don't shut them down, because communities and commerce depend upon them, and make sure that we're sharing facilities together.
I'd like to turn to something now that does cross the border rather freely, and that's energy. Quebec sells a lot of energy to Vermont and other New England states and to New York. Governor, you've mentioned some discussed maybe decommissioning Vermont Yankee, and which would mean perhaps getting more energy from Quebec. Can you, both of you, talk about the role of Quebec as a source and Vermont as a market for Quebec's electricity?
Well, you know, the Quebec is an extraordinarily important provider of our energy and will be into the future, and it's another reason why our relationship is so important. And again, this isn't anything where the federal governments are going to help us with this. It's the state negotiating with the province to make good things happen. And it's good for both of us. From Vermont's perspective, we want to be a leader in getting off of oil, in zero emissions, and energy efficiency, and I believe that's where the jobs future is for all of us. You know, as we move from an economy that's driven by oil, and if you don't agree with me on climate change, which some don't, I'm convinced, go up to your most northern territories if you don't believe me, or come down to Vermont to my farm and see the changes that have happened in the last 50 years to that land. But I can tell you that if you disagree with me on that, I doubt you'll disagree with me on the basic premise that we're not going to see $70 a barrel oil. As you watch China in particular, India, building cars as fast as they were building bicycles when I was doing business over there 30 years ago in the private sector, there's just no question that we've reached peak oil. We know what happens with peak of anything in terms of supply and demand, prices going up. And we've got to get off it to create jobs as well as for the future of the planet. So how does that relate to Vermont? Well, the more juice that we can buy from Hydro-Quebec, frankly, the better off we all are. And that is a renewable resource. Now, as Senate President last year, I passed the first law in America that designates Hydro-Quebec as green renewable power. That was somewhat controversial among some of my environmental community. And I just said, listen, folks, I can distinguish between coal and oil and hydro. I don't get the difference between big coal and small coal, big oil and small oil, or big hydro and small hydro. So we did that, and we're now working together with other governors in New England to try to encourage them to adopt the same policy. But bottom line is, we rely on Quebec for power. I want to see that reliance grow, and I think that we can also be a help to you in the future in helping to transmit power to bigger markets than Vermont that you'll be reaching as you expand that energy resource. Bottom line, there's huge economic opportunities for all of us as we get off of oil and move to other resources, and your energy future depends on us, and frankly, our goal of getting to zero emissions depends on you, so we have a bright future. In terms of the power plant, you know, I don't want to put you to sleep on this one, but we have a plant that's exactly the same design as what happens to be melting down in Japan right now, General Electric built early water-cooled system. We are the only state in the country. We have 104 aging nuclear power plants in America. We have a policy, a national policy on aging nuclear that I call, let's just put it this way, irrational exuberance, that we think that we can run these plants 30, 40, 50 years beyond their design life, and that we can store the waste on site without any problems. Now, I don't need to tell you that all you have to do is look at Japan to see what that kind of policy leads to. And my heart goes out to the people of Japan. Bottom line, Vermont is the only state in the country who has taken matters into their own hands and said that you cannot run a nuclear power plant in Vermont beyond its license date without an affirmative vote from the legislature. As Senate President, I got a 26-4 vote to shut our plant down on time because it's leaking, it's providing all kinds of problems to us, and it's run by a company that seems to have difficulty telling us the truth. They're out of Louisiana. So bottom line, I see Vermont shutting down our nuclear power plant and moving to hydro-based power, which is good for all of us.
Well, there's a lot in there, but I think it's interesting if you look at the Canada-United States relationship, strip it down to the essentials, and what is it that we have? Energy is a big, big part of that relationship. Energy, and I would say, from your perspective and mine, the environment, which has been a big issue between both our countries because we share the same ecosystem. We share the same, and that has been a dominant theme in the relationship between both countries. I experienced it at the federal level with the work around the development of the Clean Air Act, issues around climate change issues, and the Great Lakes. And you look at where have we been busy together as governors and premiers for the last 40 years, that's where we've been at work. On energy, it's an interesting story because often our American counterparts, not our governors and neighbors, but at the national level, seem to be unaware of the relation and the commitments we have. I mean, we were all a little surprised when some Americans questioned NAFTA with Canada during an election, presidential election campaign where energy is a big issue, security of supply of energy is a big issue, and you question the very agreement where another country has actually committed to guaranteeing you supply of energy. And why do you question that? Because they don't know that that's part of the agreement. Frankly, honestly, they don't know. Now, in our case, Vermont and Quebec is a very good example of how we can work together. Both Vermont and Quebec have the lowest carbon footprint in their respective countries. We supply a third of the energy that is consumed in Vermont. It was difficult in the years you and I were not there to come to the agreement, by the way. I mean, this didn't happen over time. When the first agreements, long-term contracts, were entered into over 20 years ago, there was a lot of reticence, I'm told, by regulators on the American side, to the point where there's an interesting anecdote there. They forced Hydro-Quebec to desynchronize its grid with the grid in Vermont because they had low confidence in our ability to supply. They say, well, if the Quebec grid goes down, it'll pull us down also. But lo and behold, do any of you remember the summer of 2003? I had just been elected. There's a major power. I get a call in the middle of the night informing me there's a major power shortage in all of the eastern seaboard. Ontario went down, the state of New York, everyone went down. Of course, Quebec did not go down because we had desynchronized our grid. Because of our American neighbor in Vermont had forced us to desynchronize. I remember calling the mayor of New York, Mr. Bloomberg, asking them whether he needed any energy or not. I said, we're shining up here if you need any. Gloating. But so we've entered into long-term contracts. Vermont has, as the governor has said, because of his leadership, and a bipartisan initiative, recognize that they will not discriminate against large-scale hydro. Our view is that America will not be able to meet its requirements for what is now what President Obama calls clean energy standards, used to be renewable portfolios, without access to hydro, clean renewable hydro. It just cannot happen. So we are a solution to all of this, and the state of Vermont will have been the leader in demonstrating on how this can be done. There's a perfect complementarity in regards to energy.
Well, thank you. I'd like to turn to Adam now. Do we have questions from the ether?
Yes, we do. So the first question comes from Sean from McGill, and he asks, how do you two personally feel about the quintessential Canadian and American attitudes towards each other? How can we help the rest of our countries achieve the tightness and experience of commonality that your relationship clearly shows is possible?
Well, you're going to take that one first.
Well, I'll take that one first then. I think there is an anecdote that speaks volumes about the relationship, and it happened around the war in the decision in 2003. By the American government to declare war in Iraq. And the Bush administration at the time pressured a number of governments and countries to enter into that initiative. You'll remember that the Canadian government of the day declined. There was a lot of concern in the Canadian business community at the time that this was going to be a very difficult period in the relationship between both countries. It would affect our relationship at every level. It did not. Why? because there is so much, our relationship is so intertwined at every level that even a difficult moment, and I'm not speaking of whether, you know, right or wrong, even at a difficult moment in the relationship between Canada and the United States, there was very little effect at that level. That's how well we know each other. That's how integrated we are, our families, our businesses, and that speaks to how profound the relationship is. Now, at another level, Americans, frankly, don't know a lot about Canada. And I don't fault them for that. It's the biggest, it's the most powerful country in the world, over 300 million people, and we know our American neighbors very well. That they not have that same level of knowledge about us is not surprising. Canadians, though, pay a lot of attention to what happens in the United States. Why? It is in our interests. We are heavily concentrated economically in our trade side in the United States, and so we need to pay attention, and so we do pay attention. That has been my experience, generally. Finally, I would say there's still a lack of knowledge on the respective political sides on how our political system works. The American political system is very dispersed and diverse. I mean, and still there are not enough Canadians who understand or have an understanding of how it operates and how you can make it work in a way where you are able to garner attention. I think that remains a constant challenge in our relationship with our American neighbor.
I have a student over here. I'd like to have her ask a question.
Hi, my name is Adele Archer. I'm an honors political science student at McGill. And I'm currently in an economics of climate change course writing a paper about high-speed rail. And I just had a couple of questions concerning the proposal for high-speed rail crossing borders. In my research, I found that it is going to be very expensive in terms of construction, and that the federal money that's going to be granted to enable this construction is not going to be sufficient. So there's going to be a lot of money that's going to be required on behalf of the taxpayer. And so I was wondering, when it's going over a border, how do you plan to negotiate who pays for the rest of this construction? You know, Canadian taxpayers, American taxpayers. And furthermore, on a more environmentally, on the environmental side, clearly it's a priority for both state and province, the environmental concerns. And so with the construction of an entirely new transportation system, there's going to be a large increase in greenhouse gases emissions. And so how are we going to compensate for all those emissions of the construction of this system, you know, and maybe guarantee the ridership that's going to be necessary to compensate for those large emissions?
It's a great question. You know, I think it's important first to remember about what we're actually doing, because in politics we sometimes aren't very clear. So let me be. We're talking about using the existing track that runs from Manhattan up through New Haven, up to Springfield, Massachusetts, spurs there to Boston, and then comes up from Springfield, Massachusetts, up into Vermont, Brattleboro, Montpelier, Burlington, Montreal. And we're not talking about creating a whole new track network. Our challenge is to get those tracks, frankly, into the 20th century, forgetting the 21st for a minute, because they're back in the 19th, much of the track along the way. So when we talk about high-speed rail, a better description of it would be medium-speed rail compared to what's happening in Asia and other parts of the world. Our goal right now is to use those federal dollars to upgrade those tracks so we can move from 30 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour, or 0 miles an hour, since we have no link right now from Burlington to Montreal, to 80 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour, and frankly, we're going to claim victory for the first stage when we get there. So stage one, there is adequate federal dollars to upgrade the tracks to medium speed rail. We're going to get there. That's going to build ridership, and we hope then support for what you're talking about, which is what we should be doing, the real McCoy, real high-speed rail that moves at the same speeds as the undeveloped world. So that's the challenge. That's how we're getting there. We won't be increasing greenhouse gases in terms of trail track construction because we're basically upgrading the existing track.
Maybe just rapidly, I detect in your question concern about the fact that the construction will in itself generate activity that will generate greenhouse gas emissions. I think it's important to always remember whatever we do on Earth as human beings has a consequence on the environment. And I know it's evident to say that, but because sometimes I think we work from the assumption that there's something out there that does it. It does. The real issue is, what is it that we can do that will mitigate and will have the less consequences on it? That's the real. And that's why train travel seems, not just seems, is a good choice. Now, look how the issue has evolved from the 90s when the first time in Canada the issue of a fast train was raised to today. Today, back in the 90s, I remember the airport and the airline companies being very opposed to it. It would hurt them. Since then, we have more trucks on our roads, much more traffic. The greenhouse gas issue is much clearer now than it was before. Train travel is much more popular. Is there a cost attached to this? Of course there is. But, you know, governments build roads. We also build roads. We assume the cost for building roads. Right. Who will operate it after is another issue. I have no doubt it will be, at first glance, it will look very costly. And I have no doubt it will be a huge success. Also, I would see for Canada, in regards to the Canadian project, as something very, very attractive in terms of nation building, as the train once was before. It would be a fantastic project. Now, I think we're lucky because our American counterparts are going to actually push this ahead more rapidly than we're seeing in Canada. And this is an opportunity for us that we should not miss. We should jump on this and take advantage of it and invest in it.
And certainly a part of the country where people already use trains and like them. I mean, between Washington, New York, Washington, Boston, if we can go to Montreal, hey, I'm up for it.
You know, I didn't come up here to tell you how to do politics in Canada. I'm going to try to stick to Vermont. But, you know, you have the power, as my predecessor Howard Dean used to say, and I understand you might have a little federal election coming up. I mean, make this an issue. You got the power. Make it an issue. If the federal government is dragging their feet on rail travel, let them know that your vote, that it counts, and it matters.
Would have never crossed my mind.
That's why I get the big bucks.
I'm going to turn to Adam again for...
we have a question from Heather in Toronto, and she asks, you both spoke about working with federal governments while pursuing provincial or state initiatives. Have you ever had to reconcile differing federal desires that might have gotten in the way of cross-border coordination?
I think we
kind of addressed. I've only been on a job 9 weeks. I gotta defer to the more experienced member here.
I'd say generally no. I would say, you know, would generally the federal government and us, and in my experience, and this, and what I've seen on the American side, we see the same issues and problems, and we try to work around them. Sometimes we'd like the federal government to be more aggressive on some issues, other times no. But generally, the relationship's been good. Now, we have had offices. The Quebec government has had an office in New York now for, 70 years or 60?
Longer than the federal government.
Yes. Well, you know, sometimes people reproach the fact that we have offices abroad. We remind them. We had offices in London and Paris before Confederation. So, I mean, this isn't new. We have offices in Atlanta, and we're in Los Angeles, and because we work in complement with the federal government. We're not competing with them. We support each other in what we do, and it works quite well. So, frankly, to answer the question, I'd say generally we work very, very well together.
Here.
First of all, my name is Stephen Leopold. Congratulations to both Governor Shumlin and Premier Chagnon for your eco-friendly approach to our environment. This is a two-pronged question, two prongs being one to the governor and one to the premier of the same nature. Governor Shumlin, you mentioned that there has been problems with Vermonters and other Americans understanding how eco-friendly and how green, clean, and renewable Quebec's energy is compared to all other forms that are available in large quantity. Would you like to expound upon how you think Quebec can better explain its case, though a great case has been made, obviously, but how Quebec can make its case better understood by other states concerning the fact that we do have the cleanest, greenest renewable energy?
I think I'm going to have to hold you there because we're really short on time, and if I can just go with that one question.
Sure. You know, I think, actually, I think that you're going to be blessed by oil prices in terms of that argument. And, you know, I had an experience the other day that sort of should reflect on where we are. I got a call from the Pew Institute, and they said, could you come down to Washington and talk to our annual climate change collaborative about what you're doing in Vermont on climate change? And I said, my friends, I'm happy to come, but I don't know anything about climate change except what I've observed on my own farm. I've watched my pond out back of the office turn into a dead water zone from what was a great, lively piece of water. I've watched my sugar bush be taken over by buckthorn. It used to have young saplings. I go out hunting now. I know Democrats aren't supposed to hunt, but I do. And, you know, more often or not, I'm out there in sneakers and shorts and T-shirts. I used to freeze to death as a kid. You know, I've watched the changes. And they said, well, you're the only governor and actually the only politician that mentioned climate change in your recent inaugural address. And I said, well, that's pretty depressing. That's pretty depressing. That tells you where we are in America in denial. But my point is simply this. $100 and $150 oil prices, dollars will drive people to Hydro-Quebec to a more renewable resource because you're going to have cheaper power in addition to greener power. And so I think that we should do everything we can to spread the word, but I personally believe you've got a really bright energy future. I wish we owned a part of it. I think that as oil prices go up, you're going to be able to sell energy into America as much as you can build and as much as you can transmit. And I frankly think that dollars, like most things in a capitalist society, are going to drive this debate, and you're going to be the winners.
Very brief question.
Okay.
Very brief.
Very brief. I actually had like a quick joke and then a question.
No, question.
Okay. All right, then. I won't make the joke. Okay. So, Premier Charest, you want to raise tuitions, yet you're keeping living. Yet you don't have living wages for young Quebecers. Where are your priorities? I mean, working class Quebecers.
Can we have a provincial, federal, state question?
Okay, okay, then fine. If I can't ask that, is there going to be a stop at the new arena for the train?
Is there going to be a what?
Is there going to be a stop for on the arena for the new train?
No.
Okay. All right, just checking. I like the Nordiques.
Okay, I think.
Hey, I just want to say one word. I got two kids in American colleges, and I'd kill for his new tuitions.
And as an American who just sent his first child off to a private school in New England, I'd say the same thing. So over to you, Ian. And,
Ambassador Jacobson's son attends McGill University, and David Jacobson will tell you that even though he pays the foreign student fee of, what is it, Heather, $10,000 a year? Thereabouts. He thinks it's cheap compared to the University of Chicago, and it is.
I don't even buy your breakfast down there.
Yeah. My daughter, before she transferred to Concordia, was at American University, and it was $17,000 a semester.
That's a bargain.
So so I don't think Premier Sherry really cares where the track is as long as Bombardier builds the rolling stock. Right. You know, I used to take the Amtrak train to New York, and it takes 8 hours to get to Albany, but only 2 hours to get from Albany to New York. Do you think that's a coincidence, Governor, that Albany's the state capital?
We've got to fix that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's anything more symbolic of the integrated and harmonious nature of the Quebec-Vermont-Canada-U.S. relationship than a little piece of real estate in Premier Charest's backyard at Stansted. It's called the Haskell Free Opera House and Library, and you both know it well. And half of it is in Canada, and half of it is in the United States. I think we'll make that my last word at this conference and turn it over to Antonia to close it, but just a brief word about Antonia, not without emotion. I worked with her on conferences for 10 years. She's a fantastic team leader for the MISC, and we're going to miss her. Thank you.
Monsieur le gouverneur, Madame la principale, nos invités distingués, chers collègues et amis, c'est toujours avec un grand plaisir de vous accueillir aux conférences annuelles de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de McGill et toujours avec un peu de regret de clôturer ces événements car les discussions et les débats sont d'une envergure et d'une qualité de tellement haut niveau. Or, je dois dire que cette conférence fut exceptionnelle. Une vraie expérience d'ensemble des relations canado-américaines, abordée de façon remarquable par ces conversations dynamiques et animées autour de notre table décontractée pour aborder des questions des plus importantes, des facettes complexes de cette relation unique entre le Canada et les États-Unis. Et le gouverneur et le premier ministre nous ont vraiment donné, je pense, la plus belle façon de clôturer ça. Merci encore beaucoup. Merci, David. Merci. We've strived over the past decade and a half at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada to create a space for constructive and respectful dialogue. And this conference has been a fitting example of that attempt to set a stage for engaged discussion and debate on issues of real importance to Canadians. And so on behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I want to convey our sincere thanks to every single speaker and moderator who took the time and energy, sometimes against all odds, what's going on in the country elsewhere, to join us here in person, on screen, to engage in these very interesting and dynamic conversations about the enduring challenges, but also the hope of the Canada-U.S. relationship. I also want to thank all of the participants in the audience and online, thank you, Adam, for your evident attention and appreciation, as well as your questions and comments. And I'd like to say a special thank you to my McGill students and colleagues as well. It's been a thank you very much. Thank you to all. It's been a relatively short but intense conference that would not have been possible without the dedication and effort of a great many people. And I would just like to take the opportunity to thank a few of them. Of course, Ian MacDonald and Christopher Manfredi are co-chairs and masters of ceremony. Le personnel de l'Institut, Joanne Bilodeau, Adriana Goretta, Linda Huddy, Petros Pizadaris, Faisal Ghulam Hussein, and Luke Moreau. I'd like to also thank our conference partners, the Andrew and Charles Brompton Philanthropies, Foreign Affairs, International Trade Canada, the Embassy of the United States of America, the Donner Canadian Foundation, Ogilvy Renault, Bell Canada, le gouvernement du Québec, the Dean of Arts, la chaire d'études politiques et économiques américaines de l'Université de Montréal, the Institute for Research and Public Policy, Policy Options, the University of Saskatchewan, the National Post, the Gazette, Conseil des Relations Internationales de Montréal, the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, and the Canadian International Council. I'd like to send a particular thank you to two groups. First, the Board of Trustees of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and also to the team from McGill University, all of our technical team, our media team. I want to thank you very much, and most particularly a sincere thank you to our principal, Heather Monroe Bloom, for her leadership and support. Thank you. In the true tradition of McGill University, I'd like to now call upon a student, a former student, in fact. He's just graduated and is now working for Nick Nanos in Ottawa. We heard Nick's presentation this morning. Jean-Simon Farra, to formally thank our speakers.
Governor Shumlin, Monsieur le Premier Ministre, Monsieur Biette, thank you. On behalf of the McGill community and on behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, it was a true honor, a true privilege, actually, to listen to your discussion on one of the greatest advantages of federalism, that is the possibility for provinces in Canada or states in the U.S. to engage in bilateral relations beyond their respective borders. So again, thank you very much.
Avec ça, mesdames, messieurs, je vais clôturer la conférence et vous inviter à le cocktail qui est offert par le gouvernement du Québec. Merci beaucoup.